It's very simple. It's very simple, Matt. The things that I like are good, and the things I don't like are bad.
Should we all quit Twitter? My name is Matthew Lee Anderson, and you are listening to another episode of Mere Fidelity, the podcast where we think together about the Word of God and the world we live in. Our thanks to our friends at LexImpress for sponsoring one more episode of this here podcast. You can get all the LexImpress Mere Fidelity books of the month at leximpress.com/mere fidelity, including the March Book of the Month, Pastoral Ethics, Moral Formation as Life in the Trinity by W. Ross Hastings. It's got a number of our favorite things right there in the title. Pastors, Ethics, Moral Formation, the Trinity, Life. This is a just Mere Fidelity book. I think it's a book that could combines all of our interests. So you can get 40% off on that at leximpress.com/mere fidelity. And the code for that will be in the show notes at merefidelity.com. So do that.
I got to say, Derek, every time you say thanks to Lexim for sponsoring one more episode, it always feels tenuous. Like this is going to be the last, they're going to hear this and the last time. That's it.
That's because depending on what we say in our podcast, Derek, it could always be the last time. Shout out to the merry band of Patreon supporters, too. We have not had a live Q&A with them in a while, but we need to do that this spring, and so we'll get that on the calendar. If you want to join the merry band, you can do so through merefidelity.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook if you want, if you are still on those media, but perhaps you shouldn't be. Guys, I was thinking about this. It's Alistair, and you've already heard Derek. Alistair, I was thinking about the question of whether we should all quit Twitter. And it occurred to me that we're talking about this, but we never did a full episode here on Mere Fidelity on quit Netflix. I don't think we had a throwdown conversation about how we should all quit Netflix. Am I wrong on that? I went back and looked and I couldn't find one.
I can't recall one.
Yeah. Like we made jokes about it along the way, but we didn't do a full conversation, which feels like negligence on our part. Like,
I mean, we're always committed arguing about why you're wrong. So it does seem like negligence on our part.
I mean, quit Netflix was like a take that I had that actually got some traction. It's like one of the only takes I've had in the last decade that people have taken up and thought about, which is amusing to me. But, you know, Brett McCracken wrote about it at the Gospel Coalition. There were a number of people who responded to my little quit Netflix campaign positively. And that was still the right campaign. I'm still undefeated in that one. But we're going to think about social media in this case. Alistair, you're still on social media. Can you like defend yourself? Give an account here for why you are still on these mediums, these media that are destroying your brain.
I quit Facebook in 2010, and I posted on Instagram for the first time in over 3 years, just with Venice photos.
Really?
I saw that. I liked it. It was a nice photo dump.
And I'm off Twitter more or less for the whole of Lent, apart from advertising class that I'm teaching. So I'm not really very active on social media, public social media. I'm still active on Discord and our Substack. So if those count as social media, I'm still using those. And also the sort of original Google Groups for email discussion
Google
lists
groups.
And things like that.
Google Groups.
Now, there's a name I haven't heard in quite some time.
I don't think Substack and Discord count as social media. Let's focus on the big ones. I mean,
technically they are social media.
Sure.
And I think that's worth bearing in mind that there are many different forms of social media. And what we say needs to be more specific to particular types of social media. And here I think when we talk about social media, we mostly have in mind Twitter. And that, I think, has specific problems and challenges and dysfunctions. And that is maybe what's provoking this conversation, not so much social media in a very broad sense.
I mean, I think we mostly think of Twitter, but I think actually when people think, ordinary human beings, non-listeners of this podcast, think about social media, Instagram, if they're of a certain age, is the main platform.
This is true. Instagram and Facebook as well.
That's right. Facebook for a previous generation.
Everybody's aunts and uncles.
We're geriatric millennials, and so Twitter is
you guys are. I'm mid-millennial. I'm square.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not quite as old as you guys.
Doesn't want to claim us. But then there's also the TikTok world, right? Which is a whole world unto itself.
I'm sorry. This is where I go just full on 60-year-old uncle and say, that is communist spyware. You just need to not have it. It just is. Like, it's straight up. It is. That's it. That's
but there's that reason, Derek, to not be on TikTok. But there's actually, I think,
there's many more reasons.
Yeah. There's many other reasons to not be on TikTok, which have to do with the algorithm, which have to do with the medium of short form videos and what those are doing to us. But I do have, like, if we're the old people who are ranting about TikTok, I actually do have these, like, questions about what the spectrum is on these social media and why we're so averse to something like TikTok, but something like Twitter we're going to make concessions for out of sort of ministry type of reasons.
It's very simple. It's very simple, Matt. The things that I like are good, and the things I don't like are bad. I think it's more than that. I mean, just to play devil's advocate here, I'm kind of off Twitter, not really for Lent, but for a period of days. It seemingly coincides with it, just serendipitously, partially because of the issues that I think we're all kind of aware of. You know, that it's deformative effect, and as a massive time suck. And I think part of the problem with that way things have happened now is, you know, Twitter has shifted, you know, in the last 10 years. I think I've been on it for 10 or 12, which is just in dog years, that's like, you know, a lifetime. But it was a different beast 10 years ago. And before that, it was different. The kind of conversations you could have, the algorithm and the expansion of word counts, the algorithm, what gets driven forward, you know, who's exploded in the last few years just because of their willingness to say as many inflammatory things about as many inflammatory subjects as possible, who you see, the kinds of danger of kind of context collapse. Alistair talked about this, you know, the tweet that you're having a conversation with some in-house friends, your possibility of having a small micro conversation in a little local neighborhood of the internet that isn't just going to get, you know, for that moment, the algorithm works to blast you out. And the one time you think you're having a very small conversation, all of these things just ramp up your tendency to just be mad all the time on there, and also feel powerless to do anything about it, unless you want to say, like, look, I could say something about this very dumb thing that's being said right now, but do I want to devote the next 72 hours of my life dealing with the aftermath? I know I'm right, but do I want to have to deal with all of the other things that come along with opining on important matters or even dumb matters that people will just get mad at you for? There's a cost-benefit analysis of, like, gosh, how much of a real life do I have? And what am I not doing when I'm doing this that I should be doing, right? What is, like, what's the cost-benefit? Like, there's my real actual ministry that I'm called and paid to do. There's my human children that I'm, like, called to father. There's my actual friends who need prayer and conversation, et cetera. And then there's the internet that needs my opinion, maybe. I don't know. And so, I don't know. Those are some of the things that, like, a few years ago, it just didn't feel as weight. And maybe that's part of the fact that I'm older and I have more responsibilities and there are, just my time is different. But I also just do think the game has changed and the calculus has thereby changed. So some of the initial...
Derek, I think your last metaphor that you invoke there about how the game has changed is really important, right?
Yeah.
That the introduction of algorithms in this context, in the context of communication, actually gamify speech. There's been some writing about this in the world of philosophy about how social media and algorithms actually take our speech and communications and effectively turn it into a real game where there are winners and there are losers. And the winners are the people who generate reactions and likes and or just reactions, even if not likes, but interaction. And the losers are those who don't, which means that the nature of the platform is such that it's oriented not towards cultivating conversations with people that I would know, but generating these reactions. And I'm incentivized to do that, whether I realize it or not, which means that, you know, like social media participation in it has real benefits for lots of people. There are people that we all know who could identify who use Twitter very effectively, right? To have conversations with others, to build relationships, to build networks. But it seems to be that the medium gives back in accordance to what we give to it. The more that we are willing to give to social media, the more it will give back to us by virtue of the algorithms coming in and boosting those who participate versus those who are only loosely affiliated. So the nature of the algorithms like incentivizes attachment to these platforms. It incentivizes our attention. And it incentivizes us to give more time to them in order to benefit from the cycle of giving and returning. And if you aren't doing that, or if you're moderating that, then actually the benefits that you get from the platform go down, and you start to wonder, why am I doing this at all in the first place? This isn't actually having the sorts of returns or rewards that I thought it would have.
But that it used to. I mean, yeah.
And then you effectively just become disconnected from it, right?
Yeah.
I've always found it very important to have some sort of control over the direction and the focus and the duration of my attention. And particularly important as a scholar who wants to be thinking principally about issues, to be thinking in a way that's driven by a desire to understand things on their own terms, not merely to keep up to date with the discourse. And on Twitter, there is a constant urgency to the discourse, the latest thing, and it makes it very difficult to have the sort of conversation that we have on this podcast, which is over almost 10 years now, a conversation that is ongoing, but every conversation is a different one, continuing from the same principles, the same ethos, the same common sense of the things that matter. And on social media, there is this incessant drive to talk about the latest thing and a constant distraction from one thing to another. It's incessantly diversionary. And then you have this situation where you can never give your attention sufficiently to one thing to do it justice. Every single deep issue of theology, for instance, when it actually appears in the conversation, becomes converted into something that will serve some beef, some tribal interest, some squabble, some antagonism, whatever it is. And so the very way in which it's training our attention and marshalling our attention and using our material, even if we're not giving attention in this sort of way, our material gets used in that way to position us tribally or individually relative to others and to make things personal rather than actually thinking about issues on their own terms. And it, for me, distracts from the sort of work that I need to be doing. Now, I've used Twitter for a long time to think out loud about subjects. I'm a people watcher as well, so I want to analyze the way that conversations are taking place on Twitter and other media. And I want to do that in a way that helps other people to notice what's going on in our debates and to actually reform our debates. But the more you're doing that on Twitter and you're not actually getting that much traction, the more you wonder whether it's just better stepping back for the most part and having that conversation elsewhere in a slower platform, something like Substack or something like a newsletter or some other context that's a bit more obscure like Discord.
Mm-hmm. Alistair, can I ask you, because you talked about the attention dimension, right? And the way in which you talked about it shaping our attention was mostly through the time that we spend on the platform and what it's doing to our attention in that context. But I wonder about how participation, even in limited doses, reshapes our attention when we're not engaged or using the platform. So one of the things that I have thought about quite a bit in the last few months is my default attention, to use that language, right? When I'm working on something and I want to take a break, what do I default to in terms of my mental habits, right? When I was talking about quitting Netflix, I used the same language of defaults, right? When we go home at night and we're tired and we have had dinner and we spent time with our family, what's our default go-to? What's the practice that we undertake without thinking about it, right? And quit Netflix was saying like, look, for a lot of people, the default practice is streaming television, streaming movies, watching, putting on a show, right? And enjoying that together. And that's the default practice. And what are the costs of that being the default practice? Same with default attention, right? If I'm reaching a break, where am I giving my attention? And one of the things that I found was that even though I had very carefully constrained my Twitter usage in terms of the amount of time and the hours and which hours I was going to be on it, my default attention was such that even when I was not on it, I would default to wondering what was happening on that platform rather than defaulting to other more constructive uses of my mental life, right? Like, and some of this just comes down to perhaps an underlying question of how valuable is the medium? How valuable is it for Christians to be participants in that arena of discourse and to play by those rules? But I think that even if you limit the amount of attention that you spend on the flat platform, it permeates the rest of your life by being with, like, the gravitational pull there is so strong that it's almost impossible to extricate it from your attention, even by limiting how much time you spend on it.
I think it depends on how you use it. So for my use, I always thought of it as a place to share my thinking out loud. And so much of the stuff that I was writing was not actually responding to anything that was going on the medium. It was some thoughts that I was having about a biblical passage that I was reading or something.
I did this too, which is why I was terrible at Twitter, right? I had hot takes on Trollope that I'd put up on Twitter that everybody loved.
Yep.
The people were there for the hot takes on Anthony Trollope.
And it seemed to me that if you're on Twitter, you will pay attention to some of the things that are going on there. And the sort of people that occupy people's attention more generally are the most inflammatory and provocative and generally the sort of people who have very, very little to say. So, for instance, for a while, I was paying attention to what was going on in the Christian nationalist circles. And it's just full of people who have very little worthwhile to say. And as a result, it was just a waste of time for the most part. It was not a context within which there was serious conversation going on where there would be persuasion taking place and where people were actually interested in thinking about things principially. A lot of it was just about beefs and people who are lying and slandering, and I think we all experienced a lot of this. And for that reason, it was a waste of time, and it was also a cause of, if anything, anxiety. It wasn't going to help solve anything. It wasn't going to progress the conversation. It wasn't going to leave anything constructive, even though I was trying to respond to it in those ways. And so I thought, why am I paying attention to these people? Why am I going on a platform where these people are just bombarded at me? I have better things to do with my time. And also recognizing at a certain point, I may be using this for the most part responsibly, but I am doing that against all of the tendencies of the platform as a matter of personal resistance. And it seems to me that that is always going to go against the general tendency of the platform, which will be acting upon people who are not exerting such resistance. And so by my presence there, I'm encouraging people to care about these sorts of discourses, to be present within them. And at a certain point, I thought, why invest in that way when I'm encouraging people to be on a platform that takes far more resilience and resistance than is worthwhile, when they could actually be reading good books, when they could be spending time not trying to keep up with the latest discourse, but with digging deep into things that have been said that are far more worthwhile over the history of Christian thought? And I have a life outside of Twitter, and it doesn't really register in that context. But some people are so online that
everything has to be positioned within that space. You're always signaling and positioning and every statement. And I think this is part of a problem with the live word of social media. Every statement is not just about its content, it's signal value. And so how you're positioning. Now, when you're reading a book, the words aren't live in the same way. And so you're able to judge them on their own terms. And it occurred to me that the people who are most successful on Twitter are people who are not using their intelligence so much as their wit. And even that is often lacking.
Yeah.
They're negotiating beefs and personal vendettas, and they're playing around with words, but they're not actually weighing things up and thinking deeply. And it's not a conducive atmosphere for that. And I want an atmosphere where I can think well and where I can encourage others to think well. And that isn't social media.
So I feel all that, and you've said it much better than I could in a lot of ways. What happens for me is that whole keeping up with the discourse thing as an anxiety multiplier. Twitter as an anxiety multiplier is an interesting thing because it can work in the ways you guys have described, Matt. You know, I'm not as fixated on Christian nationalist circles. I'll get random progressive pastors tweets just coming across my feed. Somebody will say some dorky, historically uninformed thing about penal substitution or something like that. It's like an absolute caricature of anything. But then you'll see it's like 1,000 likes. Like there's just millions of people reading these really dumb thoughts that are, or these caricatures and stuff. So this
hold on. You did it again. I've just got to interrupt you here. Caricature, Derek?
Caricature.
Caricature.
I don't care.
Pericope. Caricature.
Yeah, it's fine.
Characterization. I think is what we're looking for.
A caricature.
Sorry, you were making a serious point.
Yeah, I was. Anyways, the thing is, so this triggers two things. One, it triggers the point that Matt says. It doesn't matter how long you're on there, right? I can flash on, see one tweet, and then that'll be in the background of my mind for the next 24 hours as I'm formulating a very careful, nuanced response that I'm not going to post because I don't have time because I don't want to deal with the blowback on it, which I wouldn't be wrong on. So there's that. But then there's also one of the initial motivations that got me into blogging 10 years ago in the first place was that basic argument of C.S. Lewis in Learning in Wartime, which is good philosophy must exist if only because so much bad philosophy needs to be answered. And so there's this argument for staying in social media places for Christians, some Christians who have enough internal resilience because there's a lot of bad stuff that's being said. There's a lot of I'm not going to pull the misinformation trope, but whatever, the theological misinformation or formation, all of it's just falsity is out there. And so if all the thoughtful, careful people who are attentive to the gamified incentives going on go away, and I don't think they are. There's a lot of people who, again, operate responsibly, who manage to keep their walls up, who manage to say things with pastoral and Christian basic instincts on all these sorts of things, and they do well. If all of those people go away into, I want to say, the shire of a nice Discord, the Hobbiton of a nice internal Gmail email account, then there's nobody there answering sundry terrible claims. And so all you have are the worst actors on all sides playing the game against each other, right? And it's because you'll have it.
But here's where I want to push you a little bit. I mean, I like the Shire image because there's a question here about what sort of power this is and whether or not using the power of social media is equivalent to using something like the ring.
The one ring, right? Yeah.
And that calls into question whether or not we should do that. But your final point about all these people who are malicious or who are bad actors participating and going after each other, doesn't that sound great? Like lots of bad actors turning their attention against each other, forgetting that the good actors exist. The only ways in which this is malformative, these people, these bad tweets, etc., are malformative of the good, is if the good are there, right? Who are watching, who are being formed. But I think the question is, right? Like, and maybe this is just the digital Benedict option question, right? Where it's ironic to me that the very reactionary people like Rod, who's a friend, have embraced something like the Benedict option, but and will tout the need for those sorts of communities as a response to the secularizing world and modernity and all these things, but then are also very highly online while doing that. And yeah. I just wonder, like, why not Benop the whole way and everyone actually retreat from this world that is seems to be institutionalizing two different vices. One, curiositas, curiosity, and two, suspicion. Like those
don't forget
two
wrath.
Vices. Suspicion is honest,
but
wrath and those sorts of things are like they're the obvious ones, right? It's the suspicion of other people that works its way into even normie users of these, right? Where people's trust in each other diminishes considerably. And I just why not say that in response to this powerful medium, that actually the vast majority of people who want to be good and sanctified should opt out entirely and digitally ben op, like digitally Benedict option themselves and retreat.
I'm going to point out a few things with that metaphor. I love it. I love it if all that's true. But to use the image of retreat, somebody needs to be a rear guard because there's a lot of people who are, there's going to be a lot of stragglers, there's going to be a lot of weak, there's going to be a lot of, you know, to look at the issue of actors and war and all that sort of thing. There's just a lot of just normal people in these spaces who exist there. And if they're not going to leave, they're not going to have these meta conversations. They're not going to have these meta conversations about leaving Facebook, leaving Twitter, leaving whatever, and they're just going to be there. They're going to stay there. They're going to watch the same news. They're going to be on the same feeds with the same algorithms. And there's a sense in which you're leaving them at the mercy. There's an argument that you're leaving at the mercy, right? Talk about elite versus masses or leaders versus followers or any sort of kind of metaphor of us invoking a sense of responsibility. There are some who have a responsibility to speak in order to shepherd, in order to care, in order to lead, in order to, that has to be done in spaces where people hear. That has to some degree, there's an argument that some need to lead in the context where the people are. Some need to speak in the open forums and squares where speech is happening, right? So it's not just like, hey, if I quietly exit, these people will follow. They probably won't. They'll probably just listen to somebody else. They'll probably just, the algorithm will feed them something else because our dopamine receptors are the way they are. And other voices will enter the conversation. And so, I mean, Matt, I'm just going to say this. Nobody's quitting Netflix with you, right? I just to put a fine point on it, they're at most, they're switching to Hulu or YouTube TV or Peacock, or they're realizing, like, and so there's a sense in which some people will leave. As for one more thing about the online people who are really, you know, hey, let's ben op, but let me spend all my time in the Shire online. There is worry about what's coming outside. So it's not just that, you know, people like to say Twitter isn't real life. It's real enough. Right? Decisions happen on there. Conversations are shift. The discourse, people who are listening to the discourse show up in our churches and then, oh gosh, my pastor used that one phrase that, you know, such and such influencer showed me is actually code for X, Y, and Z that your pastor actually has no idea and is not connected to you. So there's a sense in which some people staying up on the discourse is staying ahead of where their people are at in order to understand what might be coming at them down the pipeline. Beyond that, it does impact decisions that impact your family, impact your communities, impact your world. Like this is the further argument. This is the hobbits to the Ents, but you're part of this world. Like that's like that. Eventually, they're coming for the forests, and so you at some point the Ents, who like to talk slow and have measured conversations, at the Entmoot, which is much better for the soul, probably have to start kicking some orc butt, metaphorically speaking. So that's my Tolkien based argument for like some people probably need to form a rear guard on social media at the very least.
I will say, Derek, I'm gonna let Alistair jump in here, but I'm gonna say like a few more people have quit Netflix than you realize.
I actually don't have Netflix right now, but we do have Peacock.
I got an email actually, genuinely, 2 days ago from someone who had quit Netflix, like finally quit Netflix about 6 months ago, with a list of changes in their family life that have happened since they quit Netflix. And it was the most heartwarming thing that I have read in ages. So, you know, I just want to say, like, there's a few of us out there. There are dozens of us, Derek. There are dozens.
That meme? There are dozens,
there are dozens of us. Dozens. Tobias Funke meme.
Oh, man.
A reference.
You'd get that if you watched Arrested Development
on Netflix. Right? Like, there's the irony, right? Like, I'm pretty sure I did watch Arrested Development on Netflix. So, Alistair, did you want to respond to Derek, though?
I think there are a number of ways in which we can be on these media to some degree without being exposed to all the worst of them. First of all, you can be very rigorous in choosing who you follow, how much time you spend on them, what you talk about on social media. You can be very careful in whether you have your account public or private, how you set up your profile. All these sorts of things are ways in which you can regulate your presence. So if Matt wants to suggest we should be completely off, I can certainly understand and encourage that decision for many. But even if you are on, try and regulate your presence on social media in ways that probably you aren't at the moment. And so I've found there are certain people who should not be on social media at all. Certainly kids should be kept, for the most part, away from social media, away from connected devices more generally, I'd suggest. It just, the amount of stuff that you're exposing them to, forget about the pornography and that sort of material. Even beyond that, the sorts of relationships that will be formed, the ways that identity gets formed online, the way that discourse, etc., happens, it's not healthy as a formative environment. But it's not healthy as a formative environment for anyone. And so your primary formative environments, the places where you think, the places where you associate and connect with other people, those have to be offline or at least online in very carefully regulated contexts. Contexts where you are mindful of the damaging effects of certain types of formation. And so for me, the question is, how can I be, if I'm going to be present on certain of these social media, how can I be there without being on there? How can I be present at certain points and interact with certain things without being mentally preoccupied with what's taking place there, without caring that much about the way that I'm being perceived there, the way that I'm signaling, whatever it is, and without allowing it to set the pace for my deliberation and reflection, without it commanding the direction of my attention. So I'm reading things that are not dictated by the latest discourse, but which are more about the things that matter to me, the things that this was something that I've always found important, but over the last few years have been a lot more mindful of. Having big projects in reading and study that command the majority of my attention. And so when I come to social media, it's working with the scraps, it's working with what's left over. But for the most part, my attention is given to big biblical reflection projects, to other projects that require deep digging down in private, in solitude, in more exclusive contexts of discourse. And then I can say certain things about that on social media, but for the most part, social media is not in the driving seat. And so if you are present on social media, those are ways that you can limit the degree to which you are on. And I just think most people, as Derek pointed, that there needs to be a rear guard. Most people should not be on social media. And if you're normalizing the presence of that and not in the process of your presence giving a lot of warnings about it as a context of discourse and thought and community and affiliation and identity, you are doing a disservice to the people with whom you're talking.
But here's...
You're encouraging more people to go on there as well.
Stop normalizing tyranny, guys. Stop Stop platforming platforms, okay?
Here's the... Like, Alistair, I think I agree with all of that, except I would note that this whole conversation is really Twitter-oriented, right?
Yeah.
Normies... And this is where, Derek, I kind of want to push back and say, like, normies are not on Twitter by and large, right? They really are on Instagram. They really are on TikTok. They really are on visual social media, right? Where what they're seeing is images, Facebook, and more than they're engaging with texts and arguments on Twitter. I mean, there's arguments that certainly happen on Instagram, right? None of, like, the main Christian influencers in this world are not on Twitter.
Twitter.
Like, it's nice that John Piper has a million followers or whatever, but he's not moving the dial in most churches the way in which women Christian influencers on Instagram are moving the dial. And I think being attentive to those differences is really important. But here's where I just want to say, like, what Alistair says about having the center of our formation be places or contexts that are not digital, I think is exactly right. But we have a generation of young people for whom that has not been the case. We are all of an age that we can remember the pre-social media days, and the deepest formation that we experience as people happened in ways that were absent social media. And so it's easier for us to have resistance to the ways in which social media forms us because we have a very different formation from our youth. And I do wonder about my college students and the amount of time that they spend, for instance, on TikTok or Snapchat and these media, and whether or not I can authentically, with integrity, encourage them to diminish the amount of time that they spend on those media if I am not myself diminishing the amount of time that I spend on my preferred media, right? And I think that actually my college students should quit those social media entirely. I think they're deeply malformative for them because they did not grow up in a world where they are inclined to read deep books or have these robust conversations. Their attention spans have truncated to the point that reading mere Christianity is very hard for them. Very, very hard for them. And I mean, this is not like flowers to me or anything, but like, I was of a generation where I came across Mere Christianity in my church library when I was in high school. And I read it, and maybe I got 50% out of it, but I read it and I don't remember thinking this is the hardest thing I've ever read. But it's a very hard book for this generation that's down. And I think that they really need to take drastic, extreme measures to retake control of their attention by smashing their cell phones, by opting out of social media, TikTok, Instagram, all of these other ones altogether. And I don't think that I can say that if I am also not willing to take similarly extreme measures to reclaim my attention and to cultivate the type of intellectual life and embody that intellectual life that I'm trying to communicate to them that's really valuable. And it's, to me, there's just a level of hypocrisy that goes on among religious leaders who are concerned about the ways in which TikTok is shaping the youth, but are themselves not always attentive to how their own lives have been shaped by Twitter and have missional reasons for being on Twitter, but wouldn't trust a high schooler to have missional reasons for staying on TikTok, right? Like, that high schooler isn't formed deeply in such a way that they're going to be able to resist the countervailing negative influences of that platform. And so that's just one side of things, right? The other question that I have for you, Derek, is and this is just a perennial question, are there some media that are so far from the media that God has revealed himself to us that to try to participate in those media is actually going to work against the grain of increasing people's aptitude for hearing revelation? If we think that God reveals himself in Scripture, are there some media, like very short videos, that shape us in such a way that they make us incapable of actually hearing the word of God in scripture, such that we should actually not participate in those media for the types of missional reasons, because to do so is actually to work against the grain of our natures as human beings, right?
Yeah, I feel that way about PowerPoint might just be bad. Presentation. I feel that way about PowerPoint presentation and sermons. And that's low key a joke. Also, deeply serious. If you ask me to give you PowerPoint to speak at any church, I'm going to tell you no. Partially because I'm lazy. Partially because it's the word of God. Just read your Bible and then listen. But honestly, though, the hypocrisy point lands to some degree, and this is why I have limited.
But college students, the next generation doesn't need to limit their time. They've got to quit entirely. Yeah, there's no half measures.
I was getting to. There's this weird thing though. When you have this thing in your hand called a phone, and you're sitting there, it's insanely difficult to not find some other thing, some other app, some other time filler that will fill the void. I mean, there's less destructive ones, right? You find get your Audible app,
read poetry,
you
man.
Get your Kindle app. Or something like that.
I'm memorizing Shakespeare's sonnets right now. Join me in my quest.
Oh my goodness. So I want to say yes. And I do wonder though, there's just that element, and that maybe this is just the evangelical deep appropriation of all things to all people, all places to all places, that like, so who's going to tell people to get off TikTok where they'll see it if you don't go to TikTok to do it? And I refuse to download TikTok. I think it's a
if there's not a TikToker?
I think it's a wicked app, and I think you should delete it right now. And I do think it. I do think all those arguments for the reduction of attention spans. One of the worst memes that hit me deep in my fears about society the other day was like all these quotes. It was like, I read a book somewhere. I saw a documentary. And right next to it, the translation was, I saw a TikTok video. And people are getting their deep arguments about and feeling and thoughts about things from 2-minute videos. I agree with all that.
2 minutes is generous.
Yeah. 2 minutes is generous.
30 seconds.
I mean, all those people who were getting Osama bin Laden pilled because people were like doing TikTok videos about how they read. They're like, have you read Osama's letter to the Western world? And their mind is being blown by this piece of terrorist propaganda, because they have an encounter. They're not being regularly exposed to deeper layers and measures of history. And so I sympathize with all that. I just don't have a really good answer beyond how are we going to get people to do it.
But here's what I want to say, Derek. Here's what we've talked about evangelicalism in the States several times in the last few months. And here's what I want to say on that. You mentioned the evangelical appropriation of these media, which is absolutely true, right? Evangelicalism as a distinct phenomenon in the state is deeply embedded with media and with shifting forms of media, right? From the handbills that Finney uses to advertise his revivals, to radio in the 1900s, mid-1900s, to social media, to video sermons, to the Bible app. Like, we're great media
to
people.
To podcasts.
Here's the question, Derek. Has any of it prevented the slide among evangelicals into worldliness and conformity and seeking respectability? Has any of it worked? And I look at the history of evangelicalism in the last 20 years and think, nope. Like, we're not in a better state by virtue of our use of these media. We seem to be not doing that well. And so the people need to be there. How will they hear if the TikToker does not TikTok to them? I think, well, but it hasn't worked.
I'm playing devil's advocate here. And because this is our show, this is how it works. So on the one hand, I don't podcast my RUF sermons. I kind of just don't. I record them. And if a student asks, an actual student I have asks, I will send them a link. And that's kind of how that works. Partially because I don't want weird attention on the ministry, but the other thing is, and so I'm there with you. The flip side on that argument though, is we actually have no idea what it would have looked like had nobody started podcasting these sermons. Had like, so there's a sense in which
It couldn't look worse than it does.
I don't know. I don't know. What would be people listening to constantly? Like, there's this level of, like, I can listen to a couple Tim Keller sermons a week and some Tony Evans and whatever it is. That's better in some ways, right? Than me listening to, I don't know, fill in the blank of whatever nonsense and some of the alternatives. And so, there's that thing of, like, we don't know what it would have looked like. We don't know what a culture that was already going to be subject to those media forces anyways, the erosion of our attention spans anyways, the erosion of a whole bunch of sensibilities anyways, were there. So again, playing devil's advocate, like comparing the church now to the church 40 years ago or whatever it is, whatever time stamp, when they didn't have certain media that we've glommed onto, we actually don't know what we would have looked like, right? We don't know how much worse we would be or how much better we would be had we not done it. And it's hard to make that kind of comparative evaluation.
Sure. I also think that in my experience, there are huge benefits to new media if used in the right way. So for instance, at the moment for the Theopolis podcast, we're doing a series on Deuteronomy. We're over 40 weeks into a series on Deuteronomy, and there are four of us discussing the text every single week. And that's the conversation that you'd never be able to have prior to the invention of the podcast. You'd either have to live in the same location, or you'd have to be in a context where and we can't live in the same location. And so there are also things like, not easily. There would not be enough to support, except if you had some sort of mega church context or some university context, which is not currently existing. You wouldn't have that sort of context for a deep, sustained conversation. Likewise, the sort of things that I've done on biblical commentary. And when I go on Twitter, I see something like a James Bajon thread, and it will be an essay in tweet form. And I do those sorts of things too. Essentially, it's a great way to draft an essay where you have one tweet per paragraph. And that's not the way most people are using Twitter. It's certainly not what I'd not encourage people to go on if they're just going to be using any old how. But if you're going to be writing an essay, that's actually a very helpful way to write a first draft, to get people thinking, to get feedback. And I've found it very productive on that front. And so a lot depends upon how these things are used. There are certain gains in new media that I would not want us to reject, because for the most part, these things have been destructive because they've been used irresponsibly. These things can be used responsibly. Most people will not use them responsibly, and most media do not offer much to the responsible user.
I think that that is all right, and it feeds into one of my favorite themes about how we all think we are the exception. And so while we will recognize that most people will not use it responsibly, we like to exclude ourselves and, you know, think that we are the ones who use this responsibly, and we will be able to resist its formative power. And all I will say is, maybe we are not the exceptions. That perhaps
the ring
we are
enters
more
the
susceptible
chat
to the formative power of these media than we realize.
I would suggest that my use of these media is exceptional.
I think, Alistair, because it's exceptional,
most people will not be using it in that way. And so I would not encourage most people to follow the example.
We agree with you that your use of Twitter has been exceptional in the past decade. I don't think there's any dispute about that. But I do think as a matter of ethics and formation, the question is, are we exceptions to these general conditions of the ways in which these media are forming us, or are we not? And do we want to be exceptional in our use of these media, or do we want to be exceptional in our commitment to other types of goods and to sanctity?
Oh, wow. Guys, social media or holiness, you pick. That's what Matt says.
I'm just saying. For some people, it might be a real choice.
It actually is for me.
Because the curiosity, curiositas, if curiositas is a vice, and it is institutionalized in these media in these ways, then it might be a real choice for some people between them. We're going to leave it there. I'm going to take the last word for myself, guys. It's always a good show when that happens. It's always my favorite show when I get the last word in. This has been a lot of fun. I look forward to you all joining me in quitting Twitter for the rest of this year. I think that will be good for the world. Let's just turn it off through the end of 2024. So join me in my campaign, Quit Twitter 2024. But if not, if you are still planning on being there, then tell someone about Mere Fidelity. Counteract the darkness by spreading the light of this conversation to everyone that you know. We are grateful for your time and attention. Thanks again to Lexham Press for sponsoring this episode of Mere Fidelity. It could be the last one. We might have reached that level. We don't know. And thanks as well to the merry band of Patreon supporters for your support. We're grateful for it. If you've enjoyed the show, rate and review us on iTunes. We do appreciate you spreading the word about the conversations that we're having here, And we're going to have more conversations in the weeks to come. We don't know what's on tap. We're kind of going 1 week at a time right now, which is par for the course for us. So we don't know what's coming down the pipe, but it's going to be fun. It'll be edifying, we hope. We're going to enjoy it at least, and we hope that you will as well. Until then, though, this has been Mere Fidelity. Little bit of a rambling conclusion there, but that's all right.